Hey, everyone. My new book, Beautiful Writers, A Journey of Big Dreams and Messy Manuscripts with Tricks of the Trade from Best-Selling Authors, is ready for pre-order. Those authors are the legends you hear here on this very show. Beautiful Writers pubs on August 23rd, and if you purchase the book now and plug in your order number over on bookmama.com, you will receive lots of really cool writerly pre-order bonuses to help you birth your own book baby. I even send you personalized book plates to include in your books for holiday gifts with 5 or more orders. I mean, how much easier is that than trying to re-gift used candles? I love win-wins. And now for the show.
Track of hours and hours and hours. That's my problem. It's not that I have a hard time sitting down and doing it. It's I have a hard time getting up out of the chair and moving around.
Oh, no, I don't have that problem. I'll look for reasons. Am I thirsty? I think so.
Good for you.
Especially if I've written something that is kind of perplexing or a little painful or I don't understand what's happening. And psychologically and spiritually and emotionally, I don't know if I really want to go there right now. I can think of a reason to walk to the refrigerator. And by the time I come back, I'm poised again and I can go back, kind of pick it up where I left off.
Don't you love hearing behind the scenes details from working writers? People who publish title after title and head out on big book tours to packed houses? I'm riveted by the habits of best-selling writers. There are seasons for book releases. Fall is a big one, headed into the holiday shopping days. Another big season is spring, March. I'm Linda Sievertson, and two of my very dear friends are coming out with novels this March. New York Times bestselling authors Terry McMillan of Waiting to Exhale and Stella Got Her Groove Back fame, and Laura Munson, whose article for her memoir, This Is Not the Story You Think It Is, got so many comments back in 2009 that it crashed the New York Times website. They're each headed out this week on tour and stopped by here to chat with us before they left. Like most writers, Terry and Laura love talking about why and how they've been so committed for so long. We'll discuss their new books, but just enough not to have their publishers panicking with spoiler alerts. Terry's novel is called It's Not All Downhill From Here. It's about Laretha Curry, a 68-year-old cutie who's got a very full and crowded life. Something happens, though, that turns Laretha's world upside down, and she's got to summon all of her grit and wit to pursue her joy and heal some old wounds and shake herself free from her midlife rut. With help, of course, from McMillan's signature posse of lovable girlfriends. Laura's novel, Willa's Grove, 4 Women, 1 Week, 1 Question, is her first published fiction book and also centers around sisterhood, with women who open their mailboxes to the same intriguing invitation. You are invited to the rest of your life. Although they lead entirely different lives, they have found themselves at similar jarring crossroads. Right when these women thought they'd be comfortably settling into middle age, their carefully curated futures have turned to dead ends. Willa Sylvester is the sender of those invites. She's reeling from the death of her husband, and as she mourns her losses, she's asking this impossible question. So now what? I loved bringing these two writers together to talk about their so now what's. You're going to hear us talk a fair amount about writing retreats, so if you want to teach, listen up, you might find this of value. Or if you've ever thought of going on a retreat, but you were like, but what is that exactly? And do I really need to? And why? You might also hear something of value. Laura and I are huge fans of the retreat model, of retreating away for our writing because life is noisy and full of responsibilities. And it often takes retreating away from that to hear ourselves think and to birth these book babies. Teaching them has changed our lives and the lives of hundreds of our clients. And not everyone can take the time or can make the investment in themselves to go on a retreat. Lord knows there were years where I could barely afford parking, much less a plane ticket. So be sure to listen to the whole show because I will be sharing my very best DIY tips for giving yourself a retreat for free, whether that's a couple of hours, a few days, or weeks. I have super specific details I have figured out over years of trial and error, and I can't wait to share those with you at the end of the show. All right, we have got a lot to talk about how to carve out time for your writing, about boundaries needed. Boy, are these ladies good at that. I took notes. Oh, and heads up, there is some swearing in this episode. Yeah, I'm going to blame Terry on that one. She might blame me. Welcome. I'm so glad you guys are here, and I love your book so much. It's just a real honor bringing my tribe mates together.
Well, we're lucky to be in your tribe, Linda.
Yes, but I want to come back to Carmel.
You do?
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Tear. It was like the honor of my life to have you in
Carmel. I want the Negro discount.
Oh, my God.
Okay. I'll be serious.
Terry, Laura is calling in from the forest.
Yeah. I'm in Montana, where I live.
Oh, Montana.
Terry, I heard you speak a million years ago in Boston when I lived there. I think your first book had just come out, and I remember sitting in the audience and just loving you. And I think it was like 19... I was working on my very first book. It was like 1988, or maybe it was 89. Does that ring a bell? Would you have been out on book tour then?
Disappearing Acts, I think.
That's what it was. It was in an auditorium with a big, full crowd in an audience, and I was in like the second row center, just looking up and idolizing you.
So,
very full circle to be on the phone with you.
Well, same here. Thank you very much.
Okay, you both have new novels coming out. And Laura, you had written 14 unpublished novels before your bestseller, This Is Not the Story You Think It Is. And Terry, have you figured out yet if this new one, It's Not All Downhill From Here, is that your 10th or your 11th published novel?
I think it's the 11th. They're not like children, you know what I mean?
You mean you don't have to remember their names?
No, I don't know. It might be the 11th or the 10th. I'm not real sure.
Either way, you have a lot in common, which is that you have a hell of a lot of ass hours just sitting down and typing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sitting in it now. Mm-hmm.
It's not great for the lower back, is it?
No, I have a special little thing here for my back, but it doesn't help. Where are you in Montana?
I live in the northwest corner of the state in Whitefish near Glacier National Park. And 30 years ago, if you had told me that I would raise two kids here and be here for three decades of my life, I would have said, are you kidding me? Because I'm originally a city girl. But I have loved living here because it is truly what keeps me on my knees in humility. You know, we're on the food chain here because there's grizzly bears wandering around. And
yeah,
it has fed my muse and it won't let go. So I think I'm here to stay.
Wow. Mm. I lived in Laramie, Wyoming for a year.
Oh, how was that?
Similar to what you're talking about.
I bonded with Laura originally because I had also lived amongst the trees off the grid. And when Laura's New York Times article came out and five people forwarded it to me in an hour, I emailed her and I said, oh my God, who are you? I felt like we had walked in exactly the same dusty old cowgirl boots. We struck up a close friendship right away, huh, Laura? We were like two city girls who by choice, insanely or not, had plopped themselves into the middle of nowhere.
That's very true. I know. Instant kindred sisters.
Yes. You have this part in your new book where Willa, your lead character, she's being called brave for moving out to the boonies. She said that she never felt brave, maybe stubborn or idealistic or unrealistic. She and her late husband had dreamed of changing the world. And to her, that wasn't bravery. That's just what you do when you have a mission. I remember people saying that to me all the time. God, you're living out in the middle of where? That's so brave. But I also didn't think of it that way. Did you feel brave at first?
Well, it almost feels like a calling in a way because there's a line in this book, Willis Grove, where one of the characters who's from Connecticut and New York City, she says, oh, I've just learned so much about myself being out here in nature. How am I going to bring it back home? And Willa, who is not me, by the way, but Willa says to her, but Jane, you are nature. And that's the lesson that I learned over and over and over again living here.
So it doesn't feel brave. It just feels really connected. And one other point is that I don't know if you guys know this, but a grove of aspen trees is one organism.
Right.
And that's amazing. What these women in this book become, like one organism, which is why it's called Willa's Grove. And that's how I feel. Just taking a walk in the woods, something always happens.
You mean always happens in the form of inspiration and awareness and connection? Because I felt that same way.
Yeah, all of those. And you can look out the window and still feel connected. But when you force yourself, and that's hard for we writers to sometimes just get out of that chair and go outside. But when I go outside and I try to every day and take walks in the woods, I'm inspired. I feel connected. I feel new. And it always brings back more to the muse when I sit back down again.
Mm-hmm. When we first moved out to the forest, it was so quiet. It was deafening. And you have a part in your book where you talk about it sounding like a drumming. I remember my ex-husband, he couldn't sleep for like 2 months because it was so loud. And we either thought, well, the aliens have an airport underground, or this is just the pulse of the earth. This is what it sounds like when you're literally away from civilization and there's no noise pollution. And then you realize that the flapping of bird wings is so loud and the calling of a moose is so loud. Anyway, I could go on and on.
Wouldn't you say that's what it is to write, though? Isn't that what we're trying to tap into? That pulse that's behind our words and in between them and left in their wake? To me, that's what I hear when I'm really tuned in. So it's not ultimately about the words. It's about your intuition and your self-awareness and your connection.
100%. God, that's beautiful. Where is your forest, Terry? What do you do for seclusion?
Close the bathroom door.
Okay, wise gal, Terry. What about this? You're on a deadline. Your publisher
yes.
is waiting for the book. And you live in Pasadena. But Pasadena
yes.
can be a noisy place with its proximity to freeways and downtown and sirens and helicopters and trash trucks and those godforsaken leaf blowers. It's beautiful. You live in a beautiful area, but like all neighborhoods, it can definitely be noisy. What do you do to tune it all out? How do you hear yourself think?
Well, where I live in Pasadena, it's pretty quiet. You wouldn't be able to hear me now, but my windows are closed. First of all, I think a lot of, I don't care where you are. There are people that live in New York City that write, you can block out the outside world if you're inside yeah. the world you're writing about. You know what I mean? I can. I've been doing it for years. I can do it when I had a baby. On one ear, you're listening to wait for him to cry or mama or whatever. But for the most part, when you're in a zone, you're in a zone. But the outside world does exist. And I can fall into the words and the images and all that. And then something kind of jerks you and you realize the trash is being picked up. And then you just go back. Right now, I'm sitting here waiting for it to rain.
Mm.
They promised me and I'm really pissed off because it's not raining yet. And I see the clouds changing. I just turned in 120 pages of a novel that I had started 3 years ago and put it aside because my agent said, Terry, you got too many characters and there's a tense problem. And I was like, you know what? Fuck you. Can I swear?
Oh, please. Oh, please.
Okay. I didn't mean to say the F word. But anyway, I didn't say it to her. I was thinking it. So maybe yeah. that helps. But I wrote a book when I was in Wyoming and the snow helped me.
Oh,
a lot.
Interesting.
I lived there for 1 year and I wrote a book and I like the sound of the snow. If you can, I mean, you know what that's mm-hmm. like.
Yeah, I'd love to add to that, Terry. To me, it's about creating a flexible writer. Like I raised flexible children and I was proud of that. That was my intention. And in myself, I've raised a flexible writer. So do you write every day? I don't think we have to. I think we write based on what our lives are like in that moment, what our habits are like, what our responsibilities are, and those change. That's something I really agree with, that flexibility is key.
Well, sometimes I don't think we have a choice.
I know.
I can shut out the outside world when I need to. I lived in Brooklyn, and then let me tell you, the trash guy could be going by. That's not going to, you know, dogs barking and all. When you're in your world, you're lost in it. And sometimes I don't hear anything, but it just depends. I'm just grateful to be able to hear nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm. I lose track of hours and hours and hours. That's my problem. It's not that I have a hard time sitting down and doing it. It's I have a hard time getting up out of the chair and moving around.
Oh, no, I don't have that problem. I'll look for reasons. Am I thirsty? I think so. Especially if I've written myself, if I've written something that is kind of perplexing or a little painful, or I don't understand what's happening, and psychologically and spiritually and emotionally, I don't know if I really want to go there right now. So I can think of a reason to walk to the refrigerator. And by the time I come back, I'm poised again and I can go back, kind of pick it up where I left off. Because I love stopping in the middle of something. I love that. Because I can tell if I'm really bullshitting myself when I go back. If it's lost, it means that I was really bullshitting myself. You know what I mean? Sort of like sex.
I feel like writing isn't just writing. I mean, it can be a walk to the refrigerator. It's living in a way that helps you define what it is that you have to say. And sometimes that's not banging on keys. That's taking a walk or a bath or whatever it is. Don't you find that to be true?
Oh, yes, God, that's how I just discovered the Time magazine. And I was thinking, I'm supposed to be reading something else today, but today is almost the first day. I just turned in these pages, and today is like the first day I actually have where I'm not writing anything. And so I'm kind of decompressing in a way. And it's kind of weird. You know this. When you're consumed and you don't even realize how much energy you actually spend in this otherness, you know? Until you have to, I don't even know how to explain it right now, but I feel like I should be rejoicing because, I'll put it this way, I didn't just finish a book, I just finished some pages, right? But I still feel a sense of relief, and now I'm a little nervous because I'm going to go on this big book tour, and I won't be back for months, a couple months, and I'm a little nervous because I feel like I'm sort of leaving these people hanging.
You know, because you already care.
Writing in hotels, and I can't do that. It won't happen. And then I'm worried that when I come back to them, will I still like them, and will they still like me? I know that sounds kind of silly.
No, I completely get it. Last summer, I was walking in the woods, and I came upon a grove of aspen trees. And I thought, oh, I've got to take a picture and send this to the women in my book. I took the picture, looked down at my phone, figured out how to look at the text feed that surely must exist for these four women and myself, only to realize, yeah, they don't exist. I made them up. That's how much our characters live in us, right?
No,
and it is a little crazy.
That's good. I've never heard that one before.
Yeah. Though. Oh, yeah.
It happened.
Sometimes I give my characters birthdays.
Ah.
And every once in a while, I'll remember them and wish them a happy birthday. I'm like, Terry, do you remember your own birthday? And forgive me, how many kids do you have?
I have two kids.
And how old are they?
They're grown up. Well, one is in college. Well, they're young adults. How about that? One is a sophomore in college, and one is 2 years out of college. So 23 and 19.
Well, cool. Do you live alone?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool.
I live alone on 20 acres in a little town.
20 acres?
Well, it's Montana, so that's sort of a postage stamp compared to what a lot of ranchers have. But this is the land that I've been a steward of for 30 years, and I love it like I love my children. And in fact, I'm about to go out on book tour also with a novel. And I always feel like the same thing. I'll be out on the road for 2 months. And I've got two books that I'm working on, too. So I totally relate with what you just said. It's like you're leaving them hanging, but I have to believe that sometimes when we are so close to our work, we memorize it like a song that's harmonious. And I think it's important to leave it sometimes so that you can come back, read it fresh, having unmemorized it, so that you can go in and realize where it's not harmonious, but maybe more discordant. And so I'm actually enjoying the idea of letting these book babies kind of hibernate for a few months and then returning back to them.
Well, this is the first time I've been in this position. I've never finished a book and been on tour and had another book in progress. This is a first for me. And had it not been a book that I started, a couple years ago and put aside, I wouldn't be in this position. So this is very new to me. And I hope it's healthy. My fear also is that when, because I can't sneak and try to write and work on this while I'm touring, or even go back and read some of the pages, it just won't work. Emotionally, there are two different types of stories and all that. It just seems like it would be cheating in a way.
Terry, you're bringing up something interesting to me, which is the idea of sneaking time to write. I've often felt when I'm in a relationship, which has been most of my adult life, I was married for 19 years and my fiance and I now we're going on 11 years. So most of my adult life has been in partnership. And I feel like when those characters, you know, in my case, I write nonfiction. I've edited fiction, but I write nonfiction. But the characters to me, when I'm working on a book, they feel like they're characters, whether I'm writing about myself or somebody else who's alive and kicking, they're still characters to me. And they talk to me. They talk to me all the time. And I will find myself looking at the football game that my guy is watching and thinking, okay, so how do I make my escape? Or we'll be cleaning the garage and I'll think, okay, so I love cleaning, but I got to get out of here. I got to get back to my book. And I often feel like if I don't set up clear boundaries with my writing, that I end up sneaking it. And I think that's hard on relationships. Your partner knows that you're eyeing the door. How do you guys rectify that? I know a lot of writers are single.
Unfortunately, I don't have a partner. I wish I had this problem.
But you have had partners.
Yeah, I mean, I was married for 10 years and I wrote a couple books. But the bottom line is that I have rules, and even rules for myself. I had an office. My bedroom was right next to my office. And my husband, he knew pretty much, don't mess with me when that door is closed. My son, it should be an emergency. When my door is closed, leave me alone. I'm off limits. Yeah. And when I open the door, just look at me. If I don't look at you, that means I'm still writing. I'm thinking about something. So don't say anything to me. Even my dog knew, don't mess with mommy.
No.
She might not pet me. If I just walk by, and my cat too, Dilbert, they just sort of knew. When she walked by us and she doesn't acknowledge us, leave her alone.
I do that in the mornings. I give myself the very first thing in the morning to write. And so I have two little ones, two little rescue dogs. So if I'm in Carmel, I always bring them with me. And I'll get up and I'll take them out first thing. But then I'll grab my computer and I'll start putting down an idea. And they know if I don't look at them, it means we are not going out again to pee for at least another hour. They just know. And as soon as I close that laptop, boom, their tails are up. They are so excited. They know we are going for a walk.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I've also learned not to feel guilty. Because when I give my time, when I gave my time to my husband, my son, whatever, I give all of it.
Yeah.
And so you just have to respect what I'm doing. And plus, I'm sitting here lying my ass off and I got to keep them straight. And sometimes you complicate it and I don't want to be derailed. And that's why sometimes I go a long time without even eating and then realize, hey, you're hungry.
Yeah. Laura, Terry talks about her characters and her fiction work as lying. She says she lies all the time. Do you think of writing fiction as a lie? Because I see a lot of autobiographical stuff happening for you, Laura, especially in this book.
Oh, really? Oh, I like to say that none of these characters is me and none of them is anyone I know. And yet all of them are all of us.
Totally.
And in terms of fiction, I've always loved fiction the most because to me, fiction is realer than real. It's distilled reality. And I'm known for my memoir, but that was the first time I had ever written nonfiction. And to the point of writing process and how do you steal away and find time for it, the people in my life, everyone in my life knows that writing is my lifeline. It has been since I've been a little girl. I have journals that go back to the fourth grade, you know, like a pink patent leather journal that says private on it. And I have them all in my office. And so I say often, and this is on a post-it actually on my writing desk, that writing is my practice, my prayer, my meditation, my way of life, and sometimes my way to life. And that's what it was in the time depicted in that memoir, in which I was going through a marital crisis. And I was really trying to tune into my thought patterns and learn how they both served and sabotaged me. Well, this book, Willis Grove, is fiction, and I cannot wait to go out on the road and not be the main character in the book. The memoir helped a lot of people, but it takes a lot. And I was promoting it for about 6 years because it came out in hardback, then paperback a year later, and was published in 9 countries. So there was a lot of being the main character. So this time I can't wait to go out and really talk about the messages of this book, which have to do with women coming together and having those conversations we need to be having, and in so many cases aren't.
Yeah. Well, both of your books are so similar in that your protagonists have this very rich sisterhood that helps them to look at life and where they're going and where they want to go and answer the big questions. I think that makes the book so universal. In Laura's book, it's Willa. And in Terry's book, it's Laretha. And they're totally lovable. And they're tribes of women. You carry them with you.
Good. I'm glad. To me, I'm trying to start a movement. I want people to read this book as a novel, enjoy it as a novel. And then I want them to long for what these four women experience when they come together. So each of them is staring down the barrel of a question that we all ask many times in our life. And that's, so now what? Maybe life didn't go the way we thought, or maybe it did and we still are debilitated by what comes next. And I hear it constantly from friends, from family, from myself. I hear it on my writing retreats that I lead. Thanks to you, Linda, who inspired me to lead retreats.
I knew you'd be amazing, and you are.
Thank you. You're thanked in this book, because this book is inspired by what I see happen over and over and over for people when they leave their daily lives. They step outside of their comfort zone, yeah, and they come together with the express intention of moving forward in their life. In my case, on the retreats, it's through the written word. But in this book, it's through the spoken word. And these women talk a lot. And if anybody thinks that there's too much talking in that book, those are the exact people who need to be having those conversations. We have grocery store talk. We say, I'm fine, when we're bleeding inside. We often, when we're at these big crossroads moments, hibernate, isolate, become islands. And I'm trying to make a case for people to step into community, but perhaps new community, like temporary community or like interlude community. And so the model of the book is, one woman asks another friend of hers who's also at a major crossroads. And then that friend asks another, and that friend asks another, right? So it's, they're not in each other's daily lives. They don't take each other personally. They're not raising kids together. They're not coworkers.
Yeah.
And I know something powerful happens when people create these sorts of communities so that they can bridge more powerfully back to their regular community. What do you guys think about that?
I think there's a safety when you don't know somebody well and they're not at home in your town. You're maybe never going to see them again. There is a letting down of pretense. There's a letting down of the shoulders. I notice it every time. By the first night, you're thinking, how are these strangers so connected already? But they come with the intention to be themselves and to be real, and then to be seen and heard and to connect with others who are in that same sort of energy is so comforting. It's so healing. And you're just real right from the get-go. You say things you never maybe have said to your real friends.
Yeah. One woman said, this is the best family reunion I've never been on. I love that.
I love that. I love that. Well, tomorrow I'm actually having a family reunion.
No kidding.
Two of my sisters that we haven't spoken in quite a few months, and they will never listen to this podcast, so I can say it. But there has just been like a misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And some really hard feelings, and I'm the oldest, and I'm a little nervous about seeing them. I haven't seen them in 7 months, and I'm having brunch with them. And I would never write about this, but I find it amazing how similar we can be and how dissimilar we can be. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when there is distance and closeness fighting with each other, against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're saying about passing something else on to another person, I don't know. I just think that it's an emotional world that we live in. And what we are learning from each other has a lot to do with how we evolve. That's all I know. And sometimes we forget. Sometimes we blow it. And sometimes there's a curve and we have to follow the curve. That's why I do it. That's why I do this in an attempt to understand. Because if I had all the answers, I wouldn't waste my time.
You wouldn't waste your time writing, Tara?
Mm-mm. If I thought I had it all figured out, I mean, that's the beauty of this process to me, is trying to not even so much be democratic, but just to jump outside of my skin and try to imagine being in someone else's heart. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
That's when I go to the refrigerator.
Yeah. Laura, that brings up a question I have for you about Willa. She has to say goodbye to something really big and face her so now what? And it made me wonder, Laura, I know you're not in that situation, but you've probably thought about it, right?
Yeah.
Well, you've looked at, will I ever have to be in this situation? And did that fuel you? Did that give you the idea as you were mulling it over for your own self? Did it give you the idea for the book?
Well, I think that writers mind their lives, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, you know, writers mind their lives.
Yeah.
Even if we're writing sci-fi, where characters sprout wings and fly out the window, we're still mining what we know or what we wonder about wandering around in this beautiful and heartbreaking thing called life. So it makes sense that this character is looking at, I can give this away because it's right at the beginning of the book. She's looking at the potential of losing this land that has been in her husband's family since the homesteading days. And he's dead. And they based their whole existence on the Emersonian dream of self-reliance. And she's realizing that without him, she's not so self-reliant.
Right.
And she doesn't know how to really engage in interdependence, community. And she realizes that there's no money. And so she's got to put this town up for auction and look at the potential of leaving. Now, that book started in my mind about 7 or 8 years ago. And it was inspired by my Haven writing retreats and what I saw happen for people in those sorts of temporary bridge communities. But you can bet that once I started to people the themes of this book and find the place for it, because it's not in Whitefish, it's in a different part of Montana that it takes place. You can bet that I was holding the mirror up to myself and wondering, you know, what would some of the most relatable crossroads moments be for these four women? And certainly being an empty nest, being single, whether your husband's died or you're single or you're divorced, that's a time to really ask that question. So now what? And a lot of people feel shame around that, right? Because we signed up for that marriage or we signed up for that move or to build that house. Or, you know, I think a lot of women are facing empty nest and that brings up a lot of shame because, you know, you have children not to have them live in your basement. You want them to fledge and yet your heart's potentially shattered and you feel guilty because you're supposed to have tools to know how to navigate it. So what I'm trying to do is have these women who have such relatable issues have those conversations, come out of that shame and hiding and pretending and really talk.
Yeah.
And that's what I needed. I'm sad that I'm not still writing this book because the book that is coming out here in March is about the 19th draft of that book.
Right.
And I'm going to miss those characters.
Yeah.
I wrote them because I needed to hang out with them and learn from them. But like I said, none of them is me and none is anyone I know, but they're all very relatable.
They're very relatable, very lovable. And I remember way back when you and I first became friends and you were not teaching yet. And you said to me, I may lose my house. And I said, no, 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 you are way too talented. You are not going to lose your house. You are going to teach. Because to me, what you had to offer was gold. And I always say there should be a writing retreat on every corner because everybody needs community. And if it's true that 80% of people want to write books, that's a hell of a lot of millions of people that want to write, and yet they don't know how, or they don't have the faith, they don't have the discipline, they don't have the practice yet, and they need community, they need instruction, they need a tribe, they need a support team. And you were so cute. You were like, Linda, I don't want to compete with you. I was like, don't even worry. There's no competition here. There is enough for everybody.
Yes, there is.
I totally agree. It's
everybody.
A more is more thing. And, you know, in fact, people come on my retreats to learn how to lead retreats, and I'm happy about that.
Me
too. It's the Starbucks model, right? It's
Me
the
too.
Starbucks model. A different Starbucks, same product, but on each street corner. That was the experiment, and they all had lines out the door. Because a writing retreat or whatever experience getting a cup of coffee is only as good as the people that make the coffee for you, the eyes that you look into, the conversations you have, the vibe of the place. And no one can lead the same writing retreat that somebody else does, just like nobody can write the same book that somebody else writes.
Right.
And that's why this work, I think, is so important. And women need to support women. Writers need to support writers. More is more here.
I am updating my website, which I haven't done in 3 years, maybe longer. I have a list of about 100 writers that I'm suggesting that people explore. And I took pictures of them on Twitter. And I have like 260,000 followers on Twitter, which I cannot believe. And people started writing down the books like, oh, wow. Like, first of all, they were shocked that I even have these books in my library. And the bottom line is that a lot of people don't know. Because a lot of people, especially young people, when they're just starting out, they know they have this itch and they want to scratch it. They don't know. If they live in Montana, they may not be able to get to Montana. Some of us don't teach. And some of them don't know where to go. And some of them don't even think that, gee whiz, there's something I could learn in a book. And so I'm trying to let them know that there are a lot of different ways that you can find your voice.
Yeah.
Everybody can't go on a retreat. Some people don't even have money to get to work.
Yeah.
And that you have to be curious and you have to excavate. You got to learn how and where to find stuff. When I wrote my first book, I was pregnant and I didn't know what I was doing, but I didn't care. I knew I had to do it and I had to find my way. And that's how it works. So many of these young people out here, they think you write a book, you're supposed to be on the bestsellers list. And I'll put it this way. My thing is even hearing what you're saying, Laura, and what Linda has said when we were at your, do you call it a retreat?
Yes, most definitely. Carmel Writing Retreat or the Beautiful Writers Retreat is what I call it.
Yes, yes, yes. I'll put it this way. I'm just glad that we are talking about all of this. Because there are a lot of people out here that have a lot of talent, a lot of things to say, a lot of things that they feel. They don't necessarily know how to go about doing this. Some of them don't go to MFA programs. They might take a class. Some people aren't even anywhere where they can do that. So reading helps, obviously. But I think that even this podcast, the fact that a lot of writers or young writers or would-be writers or older would-be writers, they know that there is a community out here that is supportive. And I think that's what I like most about what you do, Linda. And it's important because a lot of these people out here, older, younger, whatever, they need confidence. They need to know that their voices are important.
I always say if you have the ache, you have what it takes. And I don't know if you guys know, Terry used to teach at the college level and Laura now teaches. And I don't know, I wonder if you two found what I find when I teach, which is that the best writers, the ones who have the most to say and who are most likely to get published, they are often the most insecure. They're the ones who, before they read in our little groups, they offer the disclaimers about why they're not ready or why they're not good enough. And they're the ones who sign up for the retreat and then nearly back out right before they get there. And I have a theory, and that is that ignorant people are the ones who think their shit don't stink, right? But brilliant people, truly talented people, they know what quality is and they know how much it takes for great work and they know what's out there and they have a high bar about where they're aspiring to go. It's like that Ira Glass quote about how people often quit before their work no longer disappoints them. So do you guys find that the most insecure people are often the most talented?
Well, I find that the people who are most in touch with their intuition are highly sensitive people who are feeling everything all the time.
Yes.
And when you're feeling everything all the time, that can be an occupational hazard, both for being a writer and living this life. And that's why I think we shouldn't do it alone. The author Terry Tempest Williams, who has inspired me deeply in my life and in my writing, says, we write in a solitude born of community. And that's why I think writing retreats are so important. It's not necessarily just about the words. It's about what's behind them. And I'm writing a book right now about writing, but it's turned into a book about self-expression. Because you're right, it's the people on the retreat that come and they want 10 steps to publication. And I say there aren't 10 steps to publication. We have to help you get your finger on the pulse of what you have to say, how to powerfully say it in the way that only you can say it, in your unique, surprising, and essential way. And that's a process. That doesn't just happen. And so I think to answer your question or to speak to your point, I think often those people are on their knees with humility. You know, again, yes, part of why I live in Montana, because it serves up a whopping dose of humility every single day. You know, it's the people who show up who are cocksure that I've got letters after my name and I'm authority on this, and therefore you should read my book. Let's get into the story, whether it's real or imagined. Let's get into the story and truly trust the scene, because we live our life in scenes. And that's what I find, is that people are not dedicated to the scene. They're dedicated to their wisdom and their authority. And those people's work often falls flat. And that's why I think the power of a retreat is so important, because they get outside of their comfort zone and they get outside of whatever their currency is, outside of human heart language and willingness to put their heart in their hand and be real and be
maybe
supportive.
I should come to your retreat.
I would love that.
For sure. I'll go with you.
Yeah. And you know what I also love about it is that we've had best-selling authors that have come, like Catherine Stockett, who wrote The Help. She came to Haven.
Amazing.
You know, sitting next to somebody who never cares to get published. They just want to have a deeper connection with their self-expression. They want to journal again, you know, but they don't want to just sit there and swirl in the vortex of woe that can be the journaling process. So they want to intentionally learn how to express themselves, whether for interpersonal relationships or work or family members. And let's face it, if you can't bridge to yourself in that way, how are you ever going to write anything that bridges to other people? So that's what I'm really trying to help people with, their self-expression in the first place.
Well, I taught at the University of Arizona, undergrad and graduate, how, I don't know. But I'll put it this way. One of the things that I used to have, mostly my grad student, because back then everybody only wanted, all their dream was to get into the New Yorker. That was their fantasy. Oh my God, it was sickening. A lot of young writers now, all they want to do is be a best-selling author. That seems to be their goal. Not everybody, but too many of them. That never crossed my mind. Not once back then. Never. Ever, 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 ever. It was what I was writing about that was much more important to me than the outcome. It was a journey. And if somebody else could relate to it and identify with it, fine. And back then, you know, I wasn't a whole lot of African-American best-selling authors. It wasn't a lot of them. So I wasn't even going there. I was doing this because I didn't feel like I had a choice. I didn't just sit down one day and decide, you know what, I think I want to write a novel. I think I'm going to just do this. It's something that happened. And I just wish that for a lot of these young writers, that it's a little bit more organic and that they don't have these visions of grandeur, because it can really constipate you. And so what I did was this. I said, you know what? I made my students, when they wrote and they turned in their stories or vignettes or whatever, they couldn't put their name on it. I don't want their name on it. I wanted to read it and try to figure out. I wanted to hear their voices. And let me tell you, over a semester, I could read a story and tell you who was writing it.
Wow.
Because some of them were so afraid about exposing certain things about their own insecurities or whatever. And when they didn't have to worry that they were going to be identified, it was more liberating. Then we go back and then we start dealing with craft and all that. Because at first it was like, you know what? Okay, so you're from Beverly Hills. Yes, you drive a BMW and you're gay.
Yeah.
And you're worried. You're scared. Fuck your parents. You know, this is, you're here in Arizona. Write it. Tell it. I want to hear it. And let me tell you, I had some, I mean, I was in tears sometimes. A lot of us were in the class. And that was when they were lifted, when they were able to say, hey, look. And it's not just so much, I mean, a lot of times, a lot of young writers, most of what they write a lot of times I found was autobiographical, which I think is a good starting point for some, depending. I mean, times have changed. But when you know you're not being judged or graded, for the most part, you can let go. It's like doing something and nobody's watching.
Yeah.
And then from there you start to, when you read other writers that you really respect and admire, you learn something about craft. then your confidence kind of rises, goes up. And my thing now is that too many young writers, they want to be on the bestsellers list on the first book. And some of them get on there. But it's the process of this craft that I love. And it's one act of discovery after another. Because I try to tell a lot of these young writers, if I already know how it ends, why bother? If I get married, I know we're going to get a divorce. Why bother?
Yeah.
It's the process. It's the act of one discovery after another. And that's the beauty of this. And all of us have different experiences and we feel differently. We see things. And one of the reasons why I love to read is to see how other people feel, how other people think, what they see.
I agree wholeheartedly. You have to love the process. And I remember when I finally got my big dream, you know, and I was going to my first reading and it was on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and I was in a big limo with all these publishing world demigods. And I looked out the window and I thought, Gertrude Stein is right. There's no there there.
Yep.
And all of the years that I had stacked the deck that my self-worth was completely contingent on being published to wide acclaim, all of those years, like the students you're talking about, you can bet the very first essay I wrote, I sent to the New Yorker in 1988 and of course got rejected.
That was about right though. That was that's what got you in.
Yeah.
That was the goal. And some of my students ended up in the New Yorker and quite a few of them ended up getting published. Good writers. But I don't take credit for that. The only credit I take is to try to help free them. But most of them could write.
Yeah, you've got to love the process. And sure, you know, if the accolades come, that's great. But I remember turning to the head of marketing and publicity for Penguin Random House and saying, as much as I am grateful for all that you are doing for this book and its message, and I will be a tireless messenger, I just realized that this whole success thing that has driven my life is a myth. And that means that if success is a myth, then failure is too. And I felt this levity, like my shoulders just dropped 5 inches. And I said, so that means the only thing we can control is doing the work. And that's good
you
news, right?
That's it.
That is the nugget for every listener out there. If you're a writer, it's about doing the work and creating a writing practice that works for you based on who you are, nobody else.
You know what? That's so interesting that you say that, Laura. I'm having this total flashback. I remember my first book, Lives Charmed. It had been a couple of years of rejections and thinking my agent was going to drop me and on and him telling me every time, you know, you need bigger names. We almost had a deal, but the publisher says you need more famous names because it was an interview book. And it felt like this never ending cycle. And finally, I get a publisher. The book comes out. I'm getting in the media and the show Extra came to the house 2 different days, which was a really big deal. I'm living in Los Angeles. Extra's on every night on NBC. They set up cameras. Actually, they came to Katherine Oxenberg's house and they were going to interview me and Katherine Oxenberg. And then they came to Paul Williams' house and they were going to interview me with Paul Williams. And so I'm sitting there for the first shooting and there's lights all over and they've done my makeup and yada, yada. And the camera guy looks at me and he says, wow, this is big. How do you feel? And I said, I feel nothing. I felt nothing. I didn't feel gratitude. I didn't feel high. I didn't feel low. I felt nothing. I felt like this is just a regular day in my life. And it was then where I had that same epiphany, Laura, that you had, which was there was no there there. It was that Ben Affleck thing where it was like, I wish everybody could hit their dreams and realize that's not where it is. It was the work that mattered. It was all those years in the closet of writing and tinkering and feeling excited and dreaming and being proud of myself and learning and growing and meeting people. And it was the day-to-day, everyday minutes of my life that mattered, not a few five-minute spots on a television show. But it's a great lesson in that. Back, Terry, what you were saying about those young kids who just want to be bestsellers. If that's why you're doing it, it's not going to make you happy. It's okay to want to be a bestseller. I have so many clients who hit the list, and I have so many friends who've hit the list, and I feel like they knew they were born to do that, and they chased it, and it came true, and all of that felt destined. And I'm all for destiny. Go for it. And realize that if the writing doesn't make you happy, if the practice doesn't make you happy, then unless you want to go get a ghostwriter or an editing coach or somebody, it's probably not your game. You gotta love the game, or you're going to be chasing after something that's going to be empty.
Yeah, like we have to have butterflies in our stomach for this thing. There has to be a payoff or we're not going to do it. I want writers to be hungry for this process, even and especially if they're writing about really dark material. And you know that phrase, find your voice, well, I think that's a lofty claim, but I think that you know when you're in your voice, when it's flowing, when there's ease, when you lose track of hours. Pay attention to that if you're a writer, because that's where the manna is, you know? That's where the food is that will fuel you and keep you going, whether or not anybody ever reads what it is that you write.
I love when I cry.
Oh, yeah.
I love when I throw a pen or a pencil or something across the room because my characters told me what to write and I did it. I wrote what they told me to write, what they wanted me to see and tell. Yeah. And sometimes I jump up from this chair and I walk across the room and I just jump up and down and I'm like, thank you, thank you, thank you. Nobody knows that. Yeah. And my feeling always has been it's the journey. It's not the end that counts as much to me as it is the journey. How I get from here to there, it's all the stuff that happens in between. Because I can make some shit up. Just to make you put a ribbon on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's not what I'm interested in doing, even though it might appear that because of my so-called voice and all this stuff, people think, oh, you know, she's so down. They don't understand. I'm listening to what these people are telling me and what they want me to see. And that's what I write down.
Well, and you have to love it because there's a cost. You have to love the process because I think there's a real cost to being a writer. Laura, I remember your ex-husband in the book, in the memoir, said to you, he was like, I'm sick of your writing. Just get rid of it. I forget the exact words, but he was really upset. He's like, I don't want to be married to a writer anymore. And I remember when my ex-husband was on his way out the door, he said, have fun with your books. That's all you ever wanted anyway. Well, that wasn't fucking true. That was the last truth, but that's how he felt. Because when you're sitting at home and you've got that door shut, Terry, and your kids know, and your animals know.
Yep.
The people know it too, and they feel rejected. I often say, Jillian Lauren has it right. Get an office outside your damn house, because when they see you, but you're not there, when they see you, but you're not available, it leaves a mark. It leaves a mark. And that's where I think we have to have boundaries around our work. We have to be healthy. And like you said, Terry, we got to be with the people when we're with them. We got to put down that pen or we got to put down that stuff and save it for hours when people aren't watching because there's a cost to this path. It's something we're all navigating.
But not only that, but other people should have something else to do to keep them busy.
Well, I don't want to be
your source of entertainment and your source of undiluted joy and beauty. I mean, there's a time and place for everybody and everything. Some people go to work. And it's unfortunate when you work, not unfortunate, but I love the fact that I can write in my pajamas and my flip-flops and with a facial on my face and nobody's judging me. And when I need to take a nap, I take a nap, which I'm going to do when I hang up.
But girlfriend's single, honey. You are single. You're my friend. I know you're sitch. You're single and it's easier to sit there.
Even when I was married. I was married to somebody younger, so it wasn't like I was training him, but he respected what I was doing because he didn't know what I was really doing. He didn't get it, but he knew that it required solitude, so he didn't bother me. And like I said, my pets, they knew when I opened that door and I didn't go into the restroom, they would just follow me. It was like, okay, she's out for a minute. And sometimes I would open the door, we'd go outside, but sometimes when the door was closed, it's like, okay. Sometimes they would sit in there with me, but they knew, don't fuck with me.
How about you, Laura? What wisdom have you got on this one?
Oh, well, I'd love to ask you guys if you really think you can turn it off. I think you can have good boundaries, but I think anybody who knows me and loves me knows that as a writer, we're just constantly, like I said before, minding our lives. We're just paying attention. That's how we navigate life. I mean, you can take it to like a varsity level and maybe that's not appropriate. So for instance, I used to grocery shop in character. to try to understand my characters better. My kids would be like, oh, Mom, frozen peas? Are you doing that weird thing where you're grocery shopping in one of your characters again? I was like, yes, busted. Maybe that's an extreme, but I don't know that writers truly can turn it off. I know I can't.
Yeah, great point. Terry, Laretha, she is not a woman who thinks her best days are behind her, and she's 68. She's got a lot of plans. Talk to me. Is that autobiographical?
No, because I just turned 68, and I started writing this book about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I just gave her that age. I wanted her to be close to 70, but I wanted to be able to write about a character who was pushing 70, because for a lot of young people, 60 is old. And I just realized a couple of years ago when I thought about my mother died at 59 and how many of my friends and even family members are gone, and some of them didn't even make 60 or barely over 60. And I just started thinking, there are a lot of bad habits I used to have, but not for long. They weren't long-term bad habits, but they're, you know, back in the day when we were younger, we did a few illegal things. And I knew how to say no. And as a matter of fact, tomorrow will make 38 years since I've had a drink. And I just gave up stuff. I stopped eating sugar, among other things. And I just realized I feel better now than I did 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I like the way that I look for my age, you know, and I haven't had surgery. And I just think that, I mean, I'm not trying to look 50, but there are things that I realize that I still have a lot of time left to do. And whatever time that I do have, I'm going to give it all I've got. And that's the beauty
of me. And Laretha does that.
That's an understanding, something that I've come to realize, because I just feel good inside. And I think if you feel good inside, you look good outside. And there are things that we have to do, be willing to do, to treat ourselves like we're special and like we're living like we mean it. And because one day we're all going to be dead. And my attitude is I want to slide into home. If I can.
I love you, Terry.
Thank you. And it's nice to meet you too, Laura.
You too. I can't wait to read your book. And hey, I'm going to be out on the road.
Yours too, when it gets here. Even though I know they have it at Borman's.
Well, when I come to LA, we should go have a cup of coffee or something. And I'll be out there on the road too. So author sisters understand it. So maybe we could give each other some pep talks when we're lying there in those hotel rooms staring
Seattle?
At the ceiling. I'm finishing in Seattle on March the 18th. But then I go back out again in April.
Oh, God bless you, honey.
I've got 18 events in 20 days in 7 cities.
What?
I don't know what I'm doing.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I don't.
Terry's like,
but
no
good
more.
Luck to you, and make sure you take your
you
vitamins.
Too. I know. I've
and
got really good rules for the road.
I hope to see you soon. And I hope your husband's mother is okay.
Thanks, guys. All right. I love you both so much. You're the best.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Bye, Trek. Bye, Linda. Love you, too.
Bye, hun. Okay, that made me happy. If you would like to meet either of these ladies on tour, you can find them on their respective sites at terrymcmillan.com and lauramunson.com, which also has information about Laura's Haven writing retreats. We're not yet on every corner, people, but she and I are doing our best. You can find summer and fall dates for my Carmel retreats at the gorgeous La Playa Hotel on bookmama.com or beautifulwriterspodcast.com. I'm also creating my first virtual retreat. So if you subscribe to my newsletter at bookmama.com, you'll be the first to hear those details. I told you at the top I wanted to share tips for creating your own writing retreat. And rather than list my many strategies here, I thought I'd send you to a very detailed article I've written called Going Dark to Write. It's a how-to. You can search it over on bookmama.com or do a Google search for Going Dark to Write How To, which will take you to the Book Mama archives. There's so much there, and people have told me that that one article completely transformed their writing practice and helped them finish books that had been years in the making. Okay, thank you so much for your time. You know that age-old question, what would you do if you didn't get paid for it? I would be doing this. Because every time I hang up the phone from one of these conversations, I think to myself,
there is nothing that makes me feel this alive. This is my happiest of happy places. Thank you for being here with me. If you like what you've heard, I would so appreciate if you could leave a comment over on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you listen to us. It really does help others find us and push play. Until next time, write on.